Good evening and welcome to K-Chung Radio. You're listening to The Talking Show.
Hi. Yes, welcome to K-Chung Radio.
That's Steve Cato. I'm Nicholas Miller.
I'm Steve Cato, and that's Nicholas Miller.
So, Steve, I bet you wish you still lived in Canada this last week, right?
Jesus Christ.
Solomon.
Solomon Bothwell. Was it ever hot? Solomon Bothwell, it was so hot outside. It was crazy. No, it was bananas. It was really crazy. Yeah. Do you know also that actually to add an extra kick in the nads, climatologically speaking, it was actually in the middle of a cold snap last weekend in Toronto.
Okay.
So what's normally sort of like the end of summer, you know, last day to go to the cottage, use a boat or something like that, was in fact altogether unpleasant.
So both places in your life got hosed.
Yeah, although it was easy. It was, in a way, the nice thing about the colder weather was it was sort of like Joy Division type weather. You know, like wear gray, get rained on a little bit, ride bike into wind.
Like closer?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, it was grim and northern feeling. So it had sort of like a, you know, north of the wall kind of feel, feel to it, which lends a certain heroism to everyday tasks, like getting another hard drive or something like that. You're like, I'm getting another hard drive. But it's grim.
Yeah. Did those guys use synthesizers? I can't even remember.
Joy Division? Yeah.
What'd they use?
More like a, not like a synthy synth, though. Like maybe an SH-1
or something. Okay.
Maybe something with like a four voices of polyphony. Largely no modular, no patching.
Right.
And then later on, they came to use Sirius sequencing, i.e., there's a whole video, the Jonathan Demme directed video for Jesus Christ. What song is it? Anyway? But all that happens is they basically play the song live in a studio, which, in many parts of that song, indicates that all that they do is turn on sequencers and switch sequences on stuff, and then Peter Hook plays a bass solo, and then, you know, that kind of thing. But like two out of four members of the band.
Well, I think that's probably the perfect segue into the introduction of our guest tonight.
Oh no, wait, who's our guest?
Someone else highly concerned with sequences and processes.
It's been very, this has been kept from me as a secret.
Well, we have someone very special who's come a long way tonight, all the way from Ohio State University.
Shit.
Actually. Yeah.
Wow. You know, someone very close to me is from Ohio.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well, that's
your
good
boss
to know.
Is from Ohio.
Well, maybe she'll be on the show.
Someday, yeah.
Someday.
If she's ever got anything to say for herself, I'm sure we'll let her on the air sometime.
I can attest to her ability to speak and talk at great length.
I'm sure, yeah.
I could even see a collaboration on a topic that we both share.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Not so work-related.
You would, okay.
An extracurricular activity.
I'm not gonna get jealous. I'm just gonna let that one go.
Anyhow, I'd like to give a warm welcome tonight to John H. Sirach, MD, who's going to be talking us through the five-box thoracoscopic maze, which is a minimally invasive surgery.
This operation is designed to replicate the electrophysiologic effect of an open Cox maze through a closed chest beating heart approach. Placed supine on the operating room table with a large roll underneath the left scapula. Stim pads are placed on the right scapula and in the left inframammary fold anterior to the anterior X-ray line. The initial thoracoscopic port is placed in the right inframammary fold, generally corresponding to the fifth intercostal space at the anterior X-ray line. A spinal needle is used to localize with great precision the trajectory and location of each of the additional ports. A middle port is at the cephalad edge of the hilum, just anterior to the projected line of pericardiotomy. The upper lateral port is placed so as to produce a gentle trajectory over the superior vena cava into the aortic root. A fourth port is placed directly over the aortic root, immediately lateral to the mammary bundle. The initial pericardiotomy is performed anterior to the phrenic nerve, caudal to the pulmonary hilum. Two graspers are used to elevate a fold of pericardium before the incision is made so as to maximize safety. The harmonic scalpel is used to continue the pericardiotomy to a point just caudal to the oblique sinus, approximately 2 centimeters anterior to the right phrenic nerve. Note that the diaphragm is being retracted with an endochitner placed through the medial port. Cephalad, the pericardiotomy continues onto the superior vena cava reflection. In case of extensive pericardial fat, it is helpful to divide the fat before the pericardium so as to maximize safe identification of the underlying structures. It is necessary to continue the pericardiotomy fairly cephalad so as to enable a visualization of the right pulmonary artery medial to the superior vena cava when the camera is placed in the upper lateral port. A window of pericardium is then taken out overlying the aortic root. This allows visualization of the aortic root itself when the camera, again, is placed in the upper lateral port. Retraction sutures are placed over the right superior pulmonary vein and over the oblique sinus. These are brought out through the chest wall as posteriorly as possible. We begin with an initial mobilization of the superior vena cava up to the azygos vein. Note that the medial retraction of the superior vena cava with the assistant using a Kittner in the upper medial port facilitates this maneuver. Precise localization of the phrenic nerve is kept in mind at all times. Once the azygos is identified, an additional retraction stitch is frequently helpful, immediately cephalad to the previously placed one. The muscular sheath overlying the right pulmonary artery is divided sharply, and the dissection continued with a harmonic. Meticulous dissection here facilitates the subsequent encircling of the superior vena cava. The thoracoscope is subsequently placed in the upper lateral port to enable visualization of the right pulmonary artery medial to the superior vena cava. The investing sheath surrounding the right pulmonary artery is divided sharply, as shown, and the lumotip dissector, which is placed through the medial port, is used to circumnavigate the superior vena cava. Blunt dissection then delivers the glide path plastic sheath through the defect previously created in the adventitia surrounding the right pulmonary artery. At this point, the camera is placed in the lower port so as to enable precise localization of a point on the chest wall directly anterior to the azygos-SVC junction. Again, a spinal needle is used to localize this point, which is immediately lateral to the mammary bundle, as shown. This enables elevation of the superior vena cava and clear identification of the appropriate plane of dissection to enter the transverse sinus. An endochitner retracts the dome in its caudad direction so as to enable visualization of the appropriate tissue planes. At this point, the thick muscular sheath, which intervenes between the right pulmonary artery and dome of the left atrium, is clearly visible. Because of its vascularity, it is important to use the harmonic to divide it. This preliminary dissection of the right pulmonary artery away from the dome of the left atrium also facilitates subsequent circumnavigation of the right pulmonary hilum. We proceed now to the oblique sinus, where blunt dissection opens up the areolar tissue between the right inferior pulmonary vein on the left and the inferior vena cava. In cases where the oblique sinus tissue is rather thick, it is important to identify the right inferior pulmonary vein first and hug the outer aspect of the inferior pulmonary vein margin so as to avoid inadvertent injury to the inferior vena cava. It's frequently possible to visualize the distal coronary sinus from the oblique sinus. In encircling the right pulmonary antrum, it is helpful to use two Kittners, one retracting the right pulmonary artery in a northward direction, and a second retracting the dome of the left atrium in a southward direction. So opens up a large landing area for the lumotip dissector. We next proceed with high-frequency stimulation of the intraatrial groove to test for the epicardial autonomics. Positive responses are assessed with the usual bradycardia. The right pulmonary antral isolation is performed using multiple applications of this quadrupolar radio frequency clamp. It is helpful to place as much of the intraatrial groove fat into the clamp so as to maximize ablation of the epicardial autonomics. Multiple ablations are performed in different sites so as to maximize the isolation effect. Bidirectional block confirms effective isolation of both pulmonary veins. At this point, we return to the transverse sinus to complete the dissection of the left atrial dome. The defect created in the adventitia overlying the dome of the left atrium from the lumotip dissector is used as a guide point to enter the transverse sinus dissection. With northward retraction of the right pulmonary artery and southward retraction of the dome of the left atrium, the dissection proceeds in a lateral to medial direction, with eventual division of the ligament of Marshall. This dissection is carried all the way over to the left superior pulmonary vein and its pericardial reflection. It is vitally important to complete this dissection with great meticulousness in order to assure that the subsequent ablations across the dome are actually on atrial myocardium and not the overlying areolar fat. This assures consistent transmurality of the ablations across the dome. At this point, the left superior pulmonary vein is clearly visualized along with its pericardial reflection. Note that the hot anvil of the harmonic scalpel is rotated slightly away from the heart so as to avoid thermal injury. At this point, the dissection clearly has extended all the way over to the left superior pulmonary vein pericardial reflection. We next proceed with a defatting of the dome of the left atrium, again, to maximize transmurality of the subsequent ablations. For this, I picked the absolute porterhouse of left atrias as far as overlying and vesting fat is concerned. The dissection begins just over the right superior pulmonary vein, and a sweeping motion with our harmonic scalpel allows identification of the appropriate tissue plane. The dissection proceeds lateral to medial and from anterior to posterior. As the dissection proceeds posteriorly, the retracting endochitinar on the dome of the left atrium is placed more posteriorly accordingly. Because of the friability of the tissue, only minimal torque is applied with the grasper, just enough to identify the appropriate dissection plane. Again, the hot anvil of the harmonic scalpel is rotated so as to avoid contact with the heart. Because of the vascularity of this tissue, it is absolutely necessary to use the harmonic for this dissection. One can easily imagine in this patient with the thickness of the epicardial fat that in the absence of this maneuver, of defatting the dome, any ablations would be worthless. It is therefore a critical step to be performed prior to the application of any ablations. The completed dissection results in bare myocardium that completely exposes the dome of the left atrium from left superior pulmonary vein to right superior pulmonary vein. The posterior border is clearly the posterior pericardium itself. This depicts the triangle of ablations which will be created on the dome of the left atrium. We proceed first with the creation of the transmitral line. With the camera placed in the upper lateral port, the ablation probe is placed to the medial port onto the aortic root. The probe is placed at the left non-coronary commissure, immediately lateral to the left main coronary artery. Placement on the anterior mitral trigone is verified with real-time intraoperative transesophageal echocardiography. After the initial ablation is performed at the aortic root, we proceed down to the left superior pulmonary vein immediately adjacent to the pericardial reflection. Again, multiple ablations are performed at each point so as to assure transmurality. The completed transmitral line connects the two points with multiply redundant ablations. The camera is kept in the upper lateral port. The over-under move allows the initiation of the hypotenuse line to be localized precisely at the apex of the previously created transmitral line. Then the superior vena cava is elevated in conventional fashion, and the line extended onto the right superior pulmonary vein. Note that the line intersects the previously created right pulmonary vein isolation box. The dome is retracted, and the previously created two lines are easily visualized. The so-called roof line, or superior interantral line, is extended from the left superior pulmonary vein at its pericardial reflection onto the right superior pulmonary vein. This results in the creation of an enclosed triangle on the dome of the left atrium, which incorporates the connecting ablations to the anterior mitral trigone. Verification of the integrity of all of the constituent lines is confirmed with the demonstration of bidirectional block using a probe placed on untreated atrium in the center of the triangle. This is the schematic showing the completed triangle on the dome of the left atrium. We next proceed with the isolation of the superior vena cava using the left-sided clamp at a point approximately 2 centimeters proximal to the sinoatrial node at the SVC-RA junction. Again, bidirectional block is confirmed. We proceed back to the oblique sinus to ablate the autonomic bearing area between the right inferior pulmonary vein and the inferior vena cava. If the coronary sinus is visualized through the oblique sinus, then the distal coronary sinus is also ablated extensively. Again, multiply redundant ablations which overlap and essentially neutralize the entire autonomic bearing area are performed. Once this is completed, repeat high-frequency autonomic testing is performed to verify extinction of all previously positive autonomic ganglia. The distal coronary sinus, which has been completely ablated, is shown here. This completes the right chest portion of the operation, and we proceed with intercostal nerve blocks at each of the port site interspaces using a reusable liquid nitrogen cryoprobe. The applications are at negative 30 degrees for 60 seconds. This provides approximately 3 weeks of chest wall analgesia. We proceed next to the left chest. After placement of the initial port at the mid-axillary line, again in approximately the fifth intercostal space, the spinal needle is used to place the next port at the caudal edge of the hilum to enable subsequent visualization of the floor. The next port is placed in a sagittal plane in line with the left superior pulmonary vein. And finally, the last port on the left side is placed directly over the left superior pulmonary vein so as to enable as flat an angle as possible for subsequent retraction of the left atrial appendage. The pericardiotomy is begun posterior to the left phrenic nerve, again, caudal to the hilum, where the pericardium is most lax. The pericardiotomy is continued posteriorly towards the descending aorta. Cephalad, the pericardiotomy is continued onto the left pulmonary artery of reflection. Notice that a maximal margin of pericardium is left posterior to the left phrenic nerve so as to avoid traction injury. Retraction sutures are subsequently placed immediately caudal to the left inferior pulmonary vein on the posterior leaf and directly over the left atrial appendage on the anterior leaf. This second retraction suture is brought out through the medial port itself. Typically, the ligament of Marshall has been divided from the dissection previously performed through the right chest. Any residual ligament tissue should be divided either with scissors or the harmonic scalpel. Note the ablations, which are easily visible on the dome of the left atrium from the right chest. Division of the ligament of Marshall is important for purposes of autonomic denervation, as well as to facilitate subsequent circumnavigation of the left pulmonary antrum. With the dome dissection having previously completely separated the dome itself from the left pulmonary artery, circumnavigation of the hilum is quite easy. High-frequency autonomic testing is optional on this side since the previously performed dissection generally results in negative autonomic responses. The left-sided clamp is passed around the pulmonary antrum, and again, multiple ablations are performed. In cases where the left atrial appendage is large, it may be retracted using an endoscopic fan retractor. I generally use a 5mm reusable fan retractor for this purpose. After multiple ablations have been performed to isolate the left pulmonary veins, bidirectional block is confirmed across both the superior and inferior pulmonary veins. We now use the bipolar linear ablation probe to continue the line of ablations which were previously placed on the dome of the left atrium from the right chest onto the left superior pulmonary vein. This is vitally important to assure that there are no breaks and thus potential for flutter circuits on the left atrial isthmus. Using a 12mm large five-fingered endoscopic fan retractor, the apex is elevated, resulting in clear visualization of the floor of the left atrium, including the inferior vena cava, oblique sinus, and right inferior pulmonary vein. It is therefore very easy to create a line of ablations across the floor connecting the two inferior pulmonary veins. This results in a four-sided box isolating the entire posterior left atrium, and the integrity of the constituent ablations is confirmed again with a demonstration of bidirectional block using a probe placed on untreated atrium in the center of the box. It depicts the five-box lesion schematic consisting of both pulmonary vein antra, the posterior left atrium, the triangle on the dome incorporating ablations to the anterior mitral trigone, and the superior vena cava. We finally proceed with ligation of the left atrial appendage using the AtriClip device. It is important to identify the appropriate axis that the base of the left atrial appendage makes vis-a-vis the chest wall and bend the AtriClip shaft appropriately. The distal tip of the appendage is gently manipulated into the aperture of the clip itself using an atraumatic grasper. Note that excessive traction on the appendage, which obviously is quite friable, is avoided. Once the body of the appendage is delivered into the device itself is deployed. While the device is deployed, it is helpful to apply gentle traction on the appendage so as to maximize inclusion of the appendage in the clip. The retaining sutures are divided so as to avoid excessive traction on the appendage when the frame is removed. The advantage of the AtriClip over staples consists twofold. First, in avoidance of recanalization issues, but probably more importantly is the electrical isolation of potentially arrhythmogenic substrate in the appendage itself. This operation provides electrophysiologic equivalence to a Cox-Maze 3 minus the clinically rather trivial cavotricuspid line. What? It is the only minimally invasive procedure for atrial fibrillation, which combines ablation of the mitral annulus and isolation of the posterior left atrium. This allows for very high efficacy in treating even advanced atrial fibrillation with cure rates above 90%. Off of antiarrhythmic therapy. This is because this operation uniquely interrupts macro reentrant circuits in two perpendicularly oriented planes relative to the mitral valve annulus. All ablations, finally, are meticulously verified in real time with the demonstration of bidirectional block. This means that for every patient, the key electrophysiologic endpoints of the operation are attained consistently and without ambiguity.
Wow. That was pretty special, wouldn't you say, Steve?
I feel like it was almost like you had cloned yourself.
Like I'd cloned myself.
You guys talked awfully similarly to each other.
I wouldn't be surprised if he was a distant cousin.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think some of the Millers made their way after the potato famine in Ireland through Ohio.
Uh-huh. I guess there's been an awful lot of Millers on Earth. That's true.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, well, David's not milling.
No. No. You know what else is amazing is just how, you know, as complicated as that procedure sounded, it was, in terms of surgery, relatively short. I mean, there are procedures that can go on for hours and hours at a time, right? And so to have surgery performed here at Kaechung is dazzling in a way, to imagine how far surgery has come. I mean, that was practically bloodless.
Well, I mean, we don't want to mislead our listeners out there. He just narrated the surgery. It was just talking.
So who was that other guy?
That was a prop. It was just for appearances.
That was intense.
Yeah. I mean, with minimally invasive surgery, you can fake it.
Right. Right.
We just saw the things go into the prop. We didn't see inside.
Wow, and there I was just marveling at how far medicine had come. You could practically do it in a bus stop, you know?
Like you were thinking about getting one after the show.
Well, I don't know how my maze is. I think my maze is fine.
Right. Yeah.
But
what'd you think about that language he had? Pretty particular.
Very, very specific. I mean, I feel like that's the kind of language that I've always accepted. Like, well, for example, I hear from people, they say things like, the visual arts, it's just for a small group of people. I don't understand the language or reasons behind contemporary art. Why is it so baffling? And I say, everything on Earth is a special...
Well, you say something about China. A quippy thing about China, right?
What do I say about China?
I feel like I've heard someone attack you in this way before, and you said, do you think the people in China Chinese?
Just to exclude you.
Just to exclude us.
Yeah, no, they speak Chinese because they learn Chinese, you know? And, I mean, that's
it wasn't just ordained like art? It didn't just come down from the clouds?
Yeah, no, exactly. So the Chinese people learn to speak Chinese, and that's why they speak Chinese to each other. And, like, we learn to speak English, and that's why... And we're not doing it to exclude the Chinese. I'm not speaking English to exclude monolingual Chinese speakers.
Right.
You know, and I'm not... happen to have enjoyed an interest in the visual arts for a large portion of my life. I've acquired a specific set of language bits as a result of that, and I use that stuff when I talk. Okay.
And when you discourse.
Yeah, and so, I mean, the fact that it's not immediately comprehensible by all is in no way surprising. Like, what else in your life do you share a common language with everyone on Earth about? In verbal language, you know? So in this sense, I feel like, thank God. Thank God the medical...
Solomon.
Thanks Solomon Bothwell that the medical profession has its own argot.
Yeah. I mean, if they were trying... I feel like what you're talking about would be slang, right? Like a more common tongue. Like if these guys were a bit more lax and were like, you know, hand me the pointy one, and we're going to stick it in the kind of leftward. Let's stick it leftward of the heart. It probably wouldn't go. We wouldn't have gotten out of here in 35 minutes.
It might take longer. I mean, and here's the point, though, is that whether or not it's faster or not, that's how they've learned to discuss those things. You know, it's possible that you could have a surgery team that was so in tune with each other and had performed the procedure so many times that hardly any language or explanation was necessary.
Right. Just gentle manipulation, like
they
said.
Yeah, they would just, you know, and the other people in the operating theater would see what was going on and have the next tool available, you know, because they would understand how things worked.
It'd be like sports.
It would be like a well-oiled machine. It would be like
like Germany in the World Cup.
You know, I'm not even going to talk about the World Cup because I feel like most teams performed so disappointingly in this. Like most major European teams performed so disappointing in the last World Cup.
I'm glad you said European, because I was super happy with Mexico's performance overall.
I felt like South America, Latin America in general, sort of produced a new renaissance in itself, with the exception of Brazil.
Yeah.
Chile was really fantastic as well. But anyway, and here's another point, though. I mean, like, have you ever listened to cricket being called? Cricket on the radio?
No.
In New Zealand and the UK, you know, cricket's a major sport. Broadcasters broadcast the test match, the tests. They call a cricket match a test.
Okay.
I don't know why. And certainly none of the things they're saying make any... I can't form a mental picture of a game of cricket being conducted from the broadcast.
Right. Without visual aid.
And when the visual aids are available, I don't understand what's going on, because I don't understand the rules of cricket.
Yeah.
And it takes forever. So I might, with my attention span, only witness a section of the game, and then there's a whole other, I presume, who knows, other sections I'm not seeing. And I'm not, in my mind, assuming that the people who invented cricket or the people who are calling cricket are doing so with the purpose of excluding me.
You know, that might be one of the examples where they are. They're trying to alienate you, Steve.
I doubt it somehow. I mean, like, it's been very successful in certain colonies.
Right.
Pakistan and India are great at cricket, you know, Jamaica.
Yeah, I guess the counterexample are like codes,
which are deliberately designed to exclude most people.
Yeah, like, you know, in wartime, when the eagle is facing the arrows, not the...
You know what's an interesting example, cross example of both of these things, though, is that when the American military used the Navajo to communicate codes during World War II.
What was the Nick Cage movie, Wind Talkers or something?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I forgot about that movie.
I think it was called Wind Talkers, but I can't
remember. Navajo is a wonderful language.
Can you do some for us?
No. Oh, gosh, no. It's one of the most difficult languages to ever learn. Did you know that?
People say that kind of thing all the time. It's lost meaning to me.
In my brief...
Like Chinese is super hard or something, right?
Chinese is hard for us because it's an inflected language and we're not used to thinking about things that way.
Right, but then so is Korean.
Korean is simpler than Chinese.
Okay.
And it's also easier to attain adult literacy in Korean, for example. Because it's a phonetic alphabet. So you can read it like you would read English. But Navajo, when I was in linguistics, has unbelievably complex grammar. And words change radically based on their grammatical context, which does make it an ideal code language. However, at this point, everyone's onto the secret, and they're like, that's Navajo. But, you know, to the Germans, they weren't able to interpret it, and they didn't have any German Navajo speakers available to them because they were racists.
Oh, I thought it was in the Asian theater, the Pacific theater.
I thought it was you could be right. You could definitely be right.
The movie's definitely set on the other
side. Windtalkers. I did not see the movie. I assume that they maybe employed them throughout the war.
Probably, yeah.
Those poor Navajo people.
Yeah.
Largest nation within America. Terrible standards of development. Extremely poor. And largely abused by the mineral extraction industry in America for all the uranium under their lands, etc. I feel extremely bad about their fate with their extremely unique language.
Yeah.
So, back to the medical issues, though. I understand there's a few more things you wanted to say.
I was going to ask about your recent surgery.
Well, I ate shit on my bike, and because I was driving my bike home wasted, and I slid open my chin so I had like a second mouth underneath.
Vertical
my,
or horizontal?
In rough parallel with my my dominant food intake, and
Steve Keda with two mouths sounds unbearable.
Yeah. Are you ready for the real talking show? And so then I had to have it stitched up, and I went to the hospital extremely drunk, and I felt really bad because it was on Labor Day weekend,
mm-hmm.
and so it's a long weekend, and there's lots of people I thought there would be lots of people in the hospital being really drunk, because lots of people would hurt themselves on a long weekend typically.
More than in the short weekend.
Yeah, absolutely, because people are compelled to go harder.
Because they have one more night.
This is it, and then it's back to school, back to work, whatever. Right. So, end of the summer. But
you
it was actually
had no excuse.
I know. I mean, I never have any excuse. You know, the weekends all week. My wonderful career in the visual arts.
Right. Work and leisure, a perfect unity.
Just no big deal. You know, I think maybe Tuesday is when I most experience my weekend feeling. But there was, it was empty. The ER was empty. The only other person in there was a woman who was, it sounded to me from what I could make out secondhand, obviously, that she was the victim of domestic violence. And they were talking about whether or not they were going to call the cops.
Right.
And so I don't think she was particularly seriously hurt from the sounds of it, but I think that there was a more complicated negotiation. There was something really complicated happening. Mm-hmm. Next door to me, and I still felt like a heel for having my dumb drunk problem, you know, for just being too irresponsible.
Maximally invasive.
You know, well, in terms of the sidewalk and my face, sure, but
I'm talking about the other couple.
Oh. In my attention to them. I mean, he wasn't there.
Oh, okay.
They were like, she's like, I don't want to go home. Mm-hmm. And they were like, should we call the cops? And I felt like a terrible person. Anyway, I hope everything worked out okay. So that's the story of my recent brush with the medical deities.
Good. I haven't had anything recent.
Let's keep it that way, huh?
No surgeries, none. I hope they keep them all minimally invasive if I have to have one, though.
That's me knocking wood.
Knocking melamine.
No, this is a chunk of wood right here.
Oh, I can't see you because of the beautiful new mixer.
Thanks, Solomon Bothwell, for the new mixer. Hallelujah. Yeah.
Thank you, Solomon. And I think maybe we should close with that.
Praise be he, Solomon Bothwell.
One pregnant pause for our guest.
Full of wonderful pausing.
Mm-hmm. Excellent reproduction of the Five Mays. Was that what it was called?
I don't know.
I've forgotten already.
That Argo is beyond me.
Yeah. But, you know, someday, there's always another career ahead of us.
I know. That's the amazing thing about people born in our generation. Mm-hmm.
We feel no ties.
I can do it all.
Well, stay cool, Los Angeles. It's been great.
Namaste.
Good night.